Welcome to On Background here on WKXL, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For information about the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, check out nhhca.org. Paul Steinhauser on vacation this week, so flying solo for this edition of the show. We have two great guests joining us here on Background today. First, the junior U.S. Senator from the state of Arizona, Republican Jeff Flake. He made some waves when he announced that he is going to be coming to New Hampshire to participate in the Politics and Egg series, speaking on Friday, March the 16th, and stoking rumors that perhaps he is considering a run for president. We'll ask him point blank coming up in just a few moments here on the show, and also addressing whether or not there needs to be, in the view of Flake, a primary challenge for Donald Trump, and get his thoughts as well on if there's going to be a three-party race the next presidential election. Jeff Flake joins us just for moments here on the program. One of the big conversations in New Hampshire and across the country over the last few weeks has been gun violence and school safety, which, in the views of many, go side by side or hand in hand. And Steve Marchand, the Democratic candidate for governor, has seized this opportunity to advance some of his discussion points in regards to school safety and gun violence. He issued a 7-point plan. He joins us to discuss that plan coming up here on the New Hampshire Now program, and I'll offer a couple of other options which he could add to his 7-point plan, making it perhaps a 8 or 9-point plan. There's one point really of interest to me, and that is creating a waiting period for individuals who want to obtain guns, a 48-hour waiting period, in fact. It's been shown that individuals who commit suicide very often will make an impulse decision in regards to a gun, use that gun for carrying out the suicide, and it is thought that if perhaps there was a wait period for purchasing guns, that some individuals would rethink that decision. We'll talk with Steve Marchand about that and some of his other ideas in regards to reducing gun violence, and also the stance of Chris Sununu, which has been that New Hampshire's gun laws are appropriate as is, and there doesn't need to be any adaptations. You're listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Up next, U.S. Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona. On Background here on WKXL, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, minus the vacationing Paul Steinhauser. Time now for our conversation with Jeff Flake. Of course, he has been an outspoken critic of President Trump and is coming to New Hampshire on the 16th of March to speak at Politics and Eggs. Here's my conversation with Jeff Flake. I'm honored to be joined on the program right now by the junior U.S. Senator from the great state of Arizona. Of course, the senior senator from Arizona has been on this program many times before, an individual I have tremendous, tremendous respect for, and I'm excited to talk to his good friend, Jeff Flake, for the first time here on the program. Senator Flake, how are you?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate joining us for the program. So you made a little news. You're coming to the Granite State. And, of course, whenever you touch foot in New Hampshire, particularly in March, as compared to perhaps the summer months, there is going to be speculation that comes with that. You have been a vocal critic of Donald Trump. You've said a lot of things that I really agree with in regards to this president. Is there a thought to challenging him? And obviously things can change, and who knows what's going to be the case in 2020. But is there a thought on your part about the need and the potential for you to challenge him and create a contested Republican primary in 2020?
Well, I do think what there is room for is somebody saying, this is not our party. This is not where we can be and hope to have majorities in Congress or win the presidency again. So I do think that we need to go in a different direction. As for myself, I'm not planning it at this point, but I'm not ruling it out either. I think it's that important. We've got to take our country and our party certainly in a different direction.
So you're kind of taking the wait and see approach, so to speak, in regards to, you know, who else may take on, you know, this mantle. Will that be a determining factor, or do you think that you have the, you know, the skill set, the vision, and the ideas that the Republican Party needs moving forward, and that there may not be somebody to represent and have the voice that you want to have for the party?
We're still early in the process, but I do think that the president will have a challenger in the Republican primary, as well as likely an independent challenger as well. So I don't know who that will be. I can just say at this point, I think that we ought to be articulating where the party needs to go.
I think that's a key point about the independent challenger. We've talked a lot about that over the last couple of days, and you know, John Kasich floating, you know, that possibility that there may be a an independent run for president, and you know, the potential exists for him to be that candidate. And you look at the makeup of the Republican and Democratic parties at this point in time, and I think that, you know, one of the more under-discussed aspects of the last election is that you had a independent in Bernie Sanders, who came in and won the New Hampshire primary here and nearly won the nomination. You have, in my view, an independent in Donald Trump, who came in and won the Republican primary process and the presidency. But in doing so, the parties did not move more towards the center where most Americans are. They moved further to the left and right, in my view. And that is why, in my view, there's going to be a crying out for someone in the center, or, you know, someone within the Republican or Democratic parties to restore them to recognizable form for most Americans.
I share your view completely. There are, I think, a large swath of voters in the middle who are looking for something else. And right now, obviously, President Trump has gone to the right, far to the right. And the Democratic Party, most of the energy is with the far left. And so it's likely that voters will be looking for something else. You know, we're still early in the process, like I said, but I can tell you from those that I talk to and come in contact with, they're saying, you know, this can't be our party. This can't be where we go. When you look at young people, mm-hmm. You know, I think that they've been walking away from the party for years, and now I think they're in a dead run, and I just think that that's got to change.
And I think that one of the major frustrations as well is that, you know, individuals, particularly in the middle class and who are view themselves as being independent or identify a little bit with one party or the other, you know, they vote, they voice their concerns, and they don't see anything ever change in regards to problem solving and solutions. And this, you know, debate regarding mass casualty shootings is right. An example. Healthcare is an example. And, you know, immigration is another great example. And they don't necessarily care which party is the one that's in control, as long as everyone works together for solutions that benefit their lives. And, you know, those folks have been screaming for results for a long period of time. And to me, again, the election of Donald Trump was a very firm message that was sent that, you know, folks were willing to elect Donald Trump as president of the United States in order to create some sort of a change, whatever baggage that may carry with it.
I think that's right. They're looking for something else, but all we've got now is the worst kind of gridlock we've seen in decades. It's a complete game of shirts and skins right now in Congress, and the big problems, like you talked about, immigration, health care, guns, where there are, you know, solutions that we could come to. We just can't bring ourselves to do it. All the incentives seem to be wrong right now. It's a problem.
I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, in New Hampshire, one of the things that I believe is that our representatives, our senators, for the most part, you know, try to find a way to get to yes. And you look at the debate over Medicaid expansion reauthorization, which is occurring right now in the state legislature. You know, former Congressman Jeb Bradley is an individual who likes to bring people together and create solutions and to get to yes. It seems that in Washington, one of the most difficult aspects of things is that everyone tries to get to no. and to find an out for various reasons. Do you view that as being, you know, a cultural issue in D.C. that people are trying to get to know instead of yes, and that no is more effective in their view for fundraising and other things?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd describe it as cultural, but it's certainly with all the incentives, like I say, driving toward the extremes in the House. You have gerrymandered districts,
yes,
where so few are competitive, and so people are running to the extremes. And then media just pushes people to one side or another, and particularly social media, where people can just expose themselves to, you know, whatever their opinion is. And the confirmation bias or echo chamber that is now ever-present really drives people to their corners. And so it's just very difficult. And we're also reaching a time in the Senate. You know, I've only been in the Senate for 6 years, yet I'm, I think, number 63 in seniority. We've had huge turnover in the Senate. More than half of the Senate has just been elected in the last 8 years. And what that means is you have so few, fewer than half, have ever experienced the Senate or, you know, the Congress, either in the House or the Senate, working as it used to in terms of compromise and regular order. And the longer we go and the more people that come and don't experience that and don't know what it's like, the more difficult it is to actually sit down and compromise on legislation.
Right. There's such a lack of meaningful debate and conversation about the key issues, let alone addressing them. You know, having in-depth analysis and discussion and hearings and debate on the key issues facing the day, so that you do have, in fact, some of the brightest minds in the world coming in to discuss things with members of Congress and the United States Senate, and then drawing consensus and figuring out, you know, pathways to solutions off of that. Jeff Flake joins us here on the New Hampshire Now program. He is coming to New Hampshire on Friday, March the 16th, speaking at Politics and Eggs, of course, a popular First in the Nation stop for prospective presidential candidates. Senator Flake joins us on the program. I wanted to ask you about the Trump presidency as compared to what you thought it was going to be. And again, I think that judging any presidency in the current context of time, you know, can be problematic. And a lot of the effects, positive and negative, you'll see, you know, over the course of time. Certainly there's, you know, the day-to-day tweets, the devaluing of the office, the things that, you know, stand out to us about the president's behavior and how he acts as president. But in terms of the policy side and the America's role in the world aspect of things, how do you judge this president?
Well, I didn't support him during the campaign.
Right.
I just in terms of policy and demeanor and comportment, I didn't think he was what we should go for. I had hoped, regardless of that, that when he became president, that he would pivot somehow and want to govern and reach across the aisle. He hasn't really. The legislative achievements that we have been done really by just Republicans pushing forward under rules of reconciliation, where we just need a bare majority. I'm in favor of tax reform and a more conducive tax and regulatory environment and judiciary. We've had some good conservative judges appointed. As a conservative, I like that. But that's about where it ends. And some of the long-term trends really have me concerned on trade, for example. Pulling out of the TPP was a huge mistake that will haunt us for a long time. If we exit NAFTA, that will be another big mistake. In terms of our role in the world, I chair the Africa subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone more than a year, and we still haven't even nominated an assistant secretary for Africa. And a lot of these countries where we develop relationships, long-term relationships, with which allow us security and intelligence sharing, we're neglecting that. And that will have long-term implications. I just returned from the Middle East last week, and there's great concern about the lack of American leadership, the skepticism of these international institutions that we have built over the last several decades, that we're now running away from. And that has long-term implications, I'm afraid.
The story about Jared Kushner in the Washington Post, to me, was really intriguing. And one of the topics of conversation that really gets, in my view, cast aside as the administration and media kind of floods the zone with other stories. And, you know, of course, there was a grave concern about Hillary Clinton. Some things were founded, some were unfounded, in regards to the Clintons and corruption and what may come from her becoming your president of the United States. But, you know, here you've seen continually there being little to no line drawn between the business interests of the Trumps and the Kushners and the policy of the United States of America. And countries across the world are clearly noticing that and have noticed that over a period of time. I've been, you know, concerned about how Mar-a-Lago is, you know, and Westminster and entities such as that are essentially real-life pay-to-play operations. If I was a high-priced lobbyist, I would definitely get a membership to Mar-a-Lago and see if I could bump elbows with the President of the United States at the 19th hole and talk policy with him. These things should not take place.
Right. I think it's come to a head just in the last couple of days with the security clearances or lack thereof for those of the president's family. We should have never come to a point where individuals were involved and had access to the nation's top secrets without a genuine clearance. And that's very troubling. And hopefully we're moving forward in a different direction. And I am concerned about the hollowing out of the State Department and just in terms of the talent that's been there. We're losing a lot of top career Foreign Service officers and diplomats that have helped guide our image abroad. And like I said, these things have long-term implications. And I'm concerned about where we are.
In conclusion, Robert Mueller's investigation continues on, and obviously we don't know what will be the findings of that investigation. And with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, there is a significant threshold that I assume would have to be passed in order for there to be impeachment and conviction of this president. And as you referenced before, there are a lot of individuals who have lost faith in the Republican Party for not acting as an appropriate check, or Congress as a whole, acting as an appropriate check on this president. Without being too speculative, what do you think would be the threshold to meet for impeachment and conviction in regards to Mueller's investigation?
Well, I have great faith in Bob Mueller. I've dealt with him for a number of years in the House and the Senate, when over the past about 18 years.
Yeah.
And I think he ought to be allowed, as he is right now, to continue his investigation. If the president were to remove Mueller, I think that would certainly be met with great resistance on Capitol Hill. I don't think the president is going to go there. I hope he doesn't. I hope that this investigation reaches its conclusion.
Senator Flake, appreciate joining us for the program. Look forward to seeing you in New Hampshire in a couple weeks.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Look forward to it.
That is U.S. Senator Jeff Flake. This is On Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. When we return, Democratic candidate for governor Steve Marchan has laid out a 7-point plan to deal with gun violence. We'll talk about that with him when we return here on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. You're listening to On Background, here presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, minus Paul Steinhauser this week, and our next guest on the program is the lone Democratic candidate for governor right now. Steve Marchan released a 7-point plan to deal with gun violence, and he joins us right now on the show. Mr. Marchan, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate joining us for the show. So we'll start with Governor Sununu on this. And I sat and did our Pints and Politics show with him, and we talked extensively about this issue. And it is his belief, two things on it that are his belief. One, that the gun laws in New Hampshire are adequate as are, and that we do not have an issue with gun violence here in the state of New Hampshire, and therefore there is no need to adapt our gun laws. The second thing was that I asked him about whether local municipalities, towns, and school districts should be able to control what the gun laws are in their communities, on their campuses, and so forth. And he said that that would create an environment of chaos and was against that. And to me, you know, local control, whether it's on taxes or gun laws or wherever, is kind of one of the hallmarks of conservatism, and that it should be the best government is the local government. So on those two things, before we get into your thoughts and your plan, where do you see the governor on that?
I see him as weak. And what I mean by that is, a few days ago when asked about it, he said this is a federal issue, and he'll be curious was the word he used, to observe how the federal government, the federal level, does or does not act. And my experience is, when you are asked for your plan about almost anything, and your answer is that you're going to expect federal action to be the way to get things done, then you're basically saying you expect inaction to rule the day, because we see that at the federal level, a lot of dysfunction between the parties and even within them. And so I think that that's a cop-out answer. Being governor is not a spectator sport. It's a participatory thing. It requires leadership, especially at a time like this. And I do think that we can look at the best practices of other states around the country, red states and blue states, and we can see that there are things that you can measure and that work, and they reduce the risk of gun violence. And so when I say violence, by the way, I don't just mean mass shooting. I mean homicide. I mean domestic violence. But I also mean suicide. Because that's where two-thirds of gun deaths come every year in this country, is from suicide. And those require different strategies and tactics, but we know what they are, and there are proven ways to help make a positive difference as it relates to gun violence.
So let's go through the seven-point plan to reduce gun violence. There's one point which is missing, and we'll get to that later. But first one is universal background checks. How do you feel that that would be, you know, more effective in limiting these types of events like what happened in Florida?
Well, yesterday we were in Lebanon announcing the plan, and in part because Lebanon is one of the communities that has been battling their inability at the local level to do, as you described a moment ago, to exercise local control. The reason I mention this is there were a lot of folks there on both sides of a lot of these gun-related issues, including folks that were, you know, they brought their guns. By the way, very civil, had great conversations with them, too. They don't agree with me on everything. But what the thing is, this is not, we're going to take everybody's guns away. It's nothing like that. You can respect the Second Amendment and reduce gun violence. A big part of it is, what can we do ahead of when guns are acquired to minimize the chance that people that are highly unstable, that have violent records, criminal records, are at a high risk of committing domestic violence, homicide, whatever it is, suicide. And there are things that we can do. So a universal background check that includes private sales, and that includes a deeper and more comprehensive background check, are a significant way to reduce the risk of guns going in the hands of people with high risk of doing something violent. And like I said yesterday, over 90% of Americans and the vast majority of NRA members agree that we should improve our background check system. It should be done at the federal level, but there are states doing a good job of augmenting their background check system, and New Hampshire is not particularly strong in that regard. So it's an opportunity for improvement.
Red flag laws. I think that's, you know, one of the big problems that we have currently is statute. And within statute, it's very limited what there's obviously, you know, the See Something, Say Something campaign, which is so important and significant. But for police, you know, they don't necessarily have the tools necessary to implement something and do something that will change the trajectory of an individual who wants to commit an event, commit an incident. And, you know, I think that this is an area that has to be looked at. How would red flag laws work, particularly in regards to mental illness? Because, you know, individuals have rights and they have the right to privacy in regards to mental illness.
Yeah, so there are a number of states that have versions of red flag laws, and there are a number of others that are looking at it, and I think in the current environment are likely to pass it. But they're not all in blue states. You know, Connecticut has it, but so does Indiana. You know, Mike Pence was governor at the time that was instituted. So we see there's an opportunity for bipartisanship on this, and it does get at your point. There are typical red flag laws allow either parents or guardians, law enforcement officials, to use a legal process to be able to evaluate the background. So you alluded to some of the factors. They could be threats that were made to harm themselves, to harm somebody else, to do things about a mass violence. They can also deal with mental illness. And in some states, what they do to try to maintain the privacy that you mentioned is there's a system where it has to go through a judge. It allows the information to remain in a very small number of eyeballs looking at it to try to maintain privacy. And those do seem to be effective. We do find that in states that have red flag laws for long enough to measure it, that it really does seem to make a positive difference in lowering domestic violence offenses involving a gun. They help with suicide, and we see homicide down as well. So when we're looking for causal relationship between policy and outcomes, red flag seems to be one that works.
In terms of your list, one of them, it really seems like there's several that seem like good ideas, but the 48-hour waiting period to me is significant in regards to suicide. And yes. if a person is, you know, needs a gun that badly, that quickly, maybe you have a hunting trip coming up and your buddies asked you, you know, you're going to go hunting up north and you don't have a gun, you need to get a gun quickly. I mean, that certainly is a consideration. But I think that, you know, when you look at data on this, individuals who commit suicide via a gun, they usually purchase the gun almost, you know, instantaneous to when they commit suicide.
Chris, this is a big deal. One of my reasons I'm running for governor, folks that know me know there are big things we got to get done. I audit cities for a living. I was a mayor that was a very data-driven guy. I really am passionate about achieving outcomes that improve lives. And I don't like to waste time on things that I don't think help. This, I really want to bring up the impact of suicide in society. Mm-hmm. 65% of gun deaths are suicide, but we don't talk about that. And here's the stat, Chris, that alludes to what you're saying. 90% of people that commit attempt suicide via gun are successful in their attempt.
Mm-hmm.
2% of people that try to do it via drug overdose are successful. And when you talk to mental health professionals, experts in the field, they say that unfortunately it often takes a crisis. It takes loved ones seeing an attempt to recognize the magnitude of the depth that the loved one is in. And with the problem is that with guns, they work. And so there is no second chance. And the other thing we find is that most people that attempt suicide contemplate it within 5 hours or so of when they make the attempt. And so this was a place yesterday, despite some great opposition from folks that showed up in Lebanon yesterday. This was a place where I had a lot of people come up after and express appreciation.
Yeah.
Because they see that this is not about taking somebody's gun away. This is about saving lives. We could save in the states that have a 48-hour wait period have seen a 52% on average drop in gun-related suicide and a 27% overall drop in suicide. That translates, if we did it nationally, to about 12,000 lives a year that we could save if we did this policy at a national level. I think that is an incredibly positive trade-off for what is a modest wait period. And most of the folks that were there yesterday to originally oppose me appreciate that position. That's a place we can get something done. I really think so.
I agree. And, you know, that's been one of the good things about a terrible, tragic event is that there are other conversations that come up as a result of it. And I think that this 48-hour waiting period is a really good example of that. There have been other things that have been discussed that you include in there, ban on military-style semi-automatic weapons, banning bump stocks. We had talked about before empowering local communities to, in my view, create their own laws and make the determination as to what they want to do within towns, within libraries, within schools. What they decide can be what they decide, but I think that local communities should have the ability to do so. And on that, you know, the governor said that the chaos would be created, and I think that this speaks to a broader issue with New Hampshire. New Hampshire is the live free or die state, and a state, in my view, which, you know, if you look at the way our primary process works, the way that our statewide races take place, this is a state that takes its local governance really seriously. And the fact that cities and towns cannot legislate and debate their own policy on fees and on taxes, that they cannot debate what they're going to do in regards to gun laws in their own communities, that's a big problem the state has. And I think that that's something that needs to change, where there has to be more empowerment of local communities to legislate and to do what they want, because Manchester is very different than Groveton. Concord is different than Claremont. And one size fits all, whether it's the federal government or the state government, in my view, does not work.
I agree with that. And so I do think, you know, some people think there's a liberal and a conservative and it's a straight line. But on some issues, it's almost more of a circle, where the ends of the political spectrum connect. And that's where you get civil libertarian issues, passion about local control, another opportunity to get some things really done that are consistent with our culture. And I have to say, in terms of Chris Sununu, what frustrates me is I feel like, whereas people that know me know I'm a pragmatist, I have progressive values, I'm proud of them, I think I'm pretty upfront about it, I answer people's questions and work hard to get it right, I'm not somebody who's rigid in that regard. And I think that Chris is. And the consequences are, even though teachers are saying we do not want to be armed, he is okay with teachers being armed as a policy. When the school boards say, I would like to have local control on the issue, he says, no, I don't think so. When he talks about other opportunities at the state level to do something, he tends to go, I think he's so afraid on the NRA issue of the dropping from an A or A minus, and because it's such a rigid, dogmatic way of how the NRA grades people, look, I'm going to get an F. I get it. I got a D as soon as I filed as a Democrat. I got an F as soon as I opened my mouth. So, you know, once you're there, be honest. Do the work. Be honest. And you know, be proud of who you are and keep listening. And yesterday we had a lot of listening with people that I know didn't agree on everything. But by the end, we did agree on some things. And that's how we're going to get positive work done.
That's Steve Marchand, Democratic candidate for governor, joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. This hour of the show is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and this segment of the show brought to you by New England College and their Masters of Arts in Public Policy program. So if there was a number 8 on your list, in my view, it would be in regards to gun safety. And this is a very divisive, tough issue on a very divisive tough topic. But if you want to look at the problems that do occur in our state and the problems with guns that do occur, individuals who do not know how to use a gun, having a gun or having a gun and using it when they are intoxicated, shooting their buddy while they're hunting, having an incident in the house where a gun goes off. These seem to be the gun issues, if there are any, in our state. And, you know, this topic has come up that, you know, a motor vehicle is considered a deadly weapon. And therefore, there's the appropriate training and protocol that goes along with obtaining a driver's license. Same thing with boating. A gun can be a instrument, obviously, that is used to kill. It can be a dangerous weapon. It can be one that takes the lives of others inadvertently. And individuals who do not know how to use it safely are a problem, obviously, to themselves and also to society. So would you be interested in implementing measures where if individuals were going to lawfully obtain guns, they would have to take safety classes?
I agree with you and am very much open to that. there were things that weren't mentioned in the plan yesterday, which was pretty exhaustive to begin with. And so there are elements of it that get a lot more attention, perhaps, than others, maybe the waiting period, for example. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, when you look at the causes of gun-related death, part of the challenge is they're very different, and so they require different ways of thinking of mm-hmm. attacking the problem. So if we know that two-thirds of all deaths are suicide, that's one kind of problem. But then homicide, and then you have domestic violence, and then you have mass shooting, which is gets the most attention, but is obviously a much smaller percentage of the overall death than, say, suicide. But then accidental death, this is kind of to your point. This is a not insignificant part of it. It's far smaller than some of these others. But in New Hampshire, it's probably one of the bigger pieces of the pie when people are injured or die. So absolutely. And this is where, while I do think that you should be of a certain age, a minimum age, in order to handle certain kinds of weaponry, friends of mine, including lifelong Democrats who are avid hunters, will tell me focusing only on the age is sort of missing the larger point. Mm-hmm. It's really about competence. Mm-hmm. And I don't even mean in an official kind of mental health sense. I mean what you're talking about, which is, do you know how to handle a gun? And, I'd much rather have, a 21-year-old who is experienced and has had training and is using it to hunt. That is a far safer situation than a 45-year-old who just picks up a gun and decides to go out in the woods someday. So the gun safety element is significant, and I think that it's something we can do, and it would reduce, not violence so much, but it would reduce injuries and deaths.
And final thing, number nine is, okay, in sure. my view, if you are going to push forth the universal background checks and start to limit individuals who may have had, a demonstrated history of harming themselves 25 years ago or have been, charged with various things over a long ago time period, or red flag laws, which there may have been a dispute with a neighbor, and it's very difficult. You have to be clearly defined, in my view, in statute as to what background checks should encompass, what red flag laws should encompass, and yeah. and so forth. But if you're going to start to restrict individuals lawfully obtaining guns, as the pragmatic side of me says that you have to also look at individuals who are illegally obtaining guns or illegally have guns. And because a lot of times, the individuals who do everything right end up having, situations where they have they're the ones that are paying the price for in these types of incidents. The ban of military style semi-automatic weapons, that is a law-abiding citizen who wants to have a semi-automatic weapon to they could argue protect themselves and their family from the intruder. So I think that you also have to push forth, whether it's gun take back programs, whether it's a commitment to for law enforcement to go after individuals who illegally have guns, who are legally able to obtain them. There has to be that piece as well, so that it's not just looking at the individual who is the law-abiding citizen or the individual who has shown signs that keep them from having a gun. I think it has to be, from a pragmatic sense, you have to do something also about the illegal guns, because the concern is in these situations that if an individual has the will to commit a crime, if the individual has the will to commit a mass casualty event, that they're going to go about whatever mechanisms possible to do so.
Well, I agree. And one of the points that we did lay out yesterday that takes at least a bite at that, though I don't claim it'll solve everything. With the more comprehensive background checks, the data show that an overwhelming percentage of crime committed with a gun involve a private sale where there was no background check.
Right.
And so when people talk about the loophole, this is generally part of what they're referring to. The reality is, and there are exceptions, of course, but generally, when somebody goes and buys a gun and has the background check done, and they legally buy it from an authorized dealer and so forth, the overwhelming, almost 100% of the time, the gun is used in absolutely proper ways, sport, hunting, self-defense, so forth. Where the disproportionate action, negative action occurs is in these private sales that don't have the background check. And so this is where, again, it's trying to worry. Generally, most of these points are less about trying to take guns out, though the specific ban you refer to is an example. Most of them are really about how do we minimize the chance of guns getting in the hands of people that have a high risk of doing things that are violent to themselves or to others. And this gets to your point. So the universal background check attempts to at least make a dent in what you're referring to.
How do, from just quickly here, from a practical standpoint, how do you enforce private gun sales? A ban on private gun sales, or not a ban, but enforcing a background check. Guns have to be registered? Yeah. How does that work?
Okay, so there's a lot of different methods different states use. There isn't one right answer. So, for example, some states at gun shows, for example, will have an authorized law enforcement personnel there who, when you're going to purchase the gun, almost like a checkout, you have to go and you have the background check done at the private show. So if you're going to do a private show, for example, you have to have a background check a kiosk almost there.
Well, what if I want to sell my gun to you? How does that work?
Oh, yeah. So in dealing with that, states deal with it different ways. So, for example, in some states, any person or entity that wants to sell a gun to somebody else, transfer a gun for that matter, to somebody else, it doesn't even have to be a cash exchange, transfer a gun to somebody else has to become an authorized firearms dealer, even if it's an individual. The reality is that if, Chris, you and I are neighbors, and I have a gun, and I want to give you the gun, sell you or give you the gun, the reality is that quote, transaction, occurring in our neighborhood, that would be difficult to stop in real time, of course. It would be in some ways not a lot different than if you were borrowing, a kitchen appliance or, a mixer or something.
Right.
But the reality is that it's not illegal in a way that has any bite to it right now. And so I'm not pretending that if two individuals are going to do it, that we can stop it from ever happening. But you can certainly increase the consequences if something happens. And that includes liability that occurs for the person who hands the gun without a background check to the person receiving the gun. So there are different ways that different states do it. They increase teeth to it if you do it at that individual level. But they also have it so that if you are a private, anybody that is transferring or selling a gun has to either go through a system, an authorized system, the state system, if they have one, or they have to themselves become an authorized person. But different states deal with it different ways.
Steve, appreciate joining us for the program. Look forward to talking again soon.
All right. Thank you, Chris, very much.
That is Steve Marchand, Democratic candidate for governor here in the state of New Hampshire. I am Chris Ryan. You're listening to On Background here on WKXL, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We'll come back and wrap things up after this. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Well, we have some presidential activity in the Granite State over the next couple of weeks, not just with the appearance of Jeff Flake, who we heard previous on the show at Politics and Eggs coming up on March the 16th, but also an appearance this weekend by the only declared presidential candidate, that is Congressman John Delaney, the Democrat from Maryland in New Hampshire once again. He comes here on a monthly basis, and he's making the trip to the Granite State with stops on Sunday as well as Monday. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for On Background, which is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.